Let's open up to Genesis chapter number 12 as we begin our story once again of the father of our faith, Abraham. Genesis chapter 12, verse number 1 says this, "Now he who is said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So God selected Abraham, at this time his name was Abram, to leave behind everything that he knew and go to a place that God would designate for him. That land is to the south of where he was at, and it's called Canaan. So he heads that direction. But as he goes, he is a new believer. He has a newfound faith, and with that faith is this promise that everywhere he goes, God's going to be helping him out. And God is even going to be using him to bless the people he comes into contact with, provided they are treating him well. Otherwise, they're going to have problems. So this is the Abrahamic blessing as it first appears in sacred scripture. I think the most significant part of this is at the end of verse number 3, where it says, "In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed," because later that will be rephrased as, "In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And Paul takes that wording in the book of Galatians and points out that the word seed is singular and is a reference to Jesus, the ultimate descendant of Abraham by the flesh, who became the atoning sacrifice for sin, and by that provided the avenue by which we could be blessed by God with the forgiveness of sin and the filling of the Holy Spirit and the ability to be born again to a new life of righteousness and holiness. So we have here the beginning of the gospel story in Genesis chapter 12. Now, the book of Hebrews makes a big deal out of the fact that Abraham exercised his faith by action. The book of James also makes a note of this, that he didn't just simply hear the word and then ignore it. He was a doer of the word. So he's been told, leave, go south. We know that he's 75. We're about to read that again. When he leaves, that his father has just recently deceased at Haran, and he is going to be leaving with a full entourage. Verse number 4. "So Abram went, as he who is had told him. Lot went with him," that's his nephew. "Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran." Now that means that his wife, his half-sister, is 66. She's mentioned next. "Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran." So this is not just immediate family. It is a big business that's moving here. It is a corporation, as we would say today. There are several hundred retainers that are working for Abram, and even some additional ones working for Lot. And, of course, all of those people are going to have their families and their children. So we've effectively got a small city that's on the move here with Abram and all of their sheep and their cattle and their goats and whatever other animals, donkeys and things of that nature that they're using for porting all of their material. So this huge group leaves, and it says they set out to go to the land of Canaan. And that's several days travel away if you're just traveling by yourself. When you've got a great big entourage like this that probably includes younger children and younger animals, maybe some older people that are a little bit more frail, it's going to take them probably several weeks to make this trip. When they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land. So more than likely, he would have followed the valleys that lead from watershed wadis and rivers that had been dumping from the south up into the Euphrates. Because his trip would have taken him, first of all, along this Habor River, I think that's the name of it, from Haran, down to where the Euphrates River has this little bend to the north of the Promised Land. From there, he would have followed the trade routes, what I think it's called very anciently, the royal or the king's route. And this route would take you down through where Damascus is going to be. I'm not so sure that Damascus was there the first time that Abram passes through. I think it might actually come into existence thanks to him being in that region. But anyway, he comes down past where Damascus is today, and he either passes on the east side of Mount Hermon, or he passes on the west side of Mount Hermon. And he then comes down into the Golan, the Golan Heights, as they're called today, which is right there to the north, particularly to the northeast of the Sea of Galilee. He would have come past the upward portions of the Jordan River. And then at some point, he goes up into the hill country of what will be Samaria one of these days, northern Israel. And he comes to a very prominent geophysical place that is called Shechem. Shechem has to do with shoulders, and more than likely it has its name because there are two prominent hills or high places here, one to the north and one to the south, on either side of this little valley where there's a community that's grown up near a water source. And so he comes to the city of Shoulders, Shechem. And there are Canaanites living there. Remember in the Table of Nations, we talked about how the Canaanites ranged all over what is the Promised Land. Now, don't think about this place being horrendously populated. Remember, this is way back in history. This is not horribly long after the flood. People are reproducing and are populating the world, but it's going to take them a while to really become very close in connection to one another population-wise. Let's think about this. Today's world population is approaching somewhere around 8 billion. Back in the time of Jesus, the estimated population of the world was only about 300 million. That's less people than what live in the United States right now. In the time of Abram, it would have been even less than 300 million in the entire world, probably somewhere in the 100 million to 150 million range. And all those people are scattered over the face of the earth. So in the Promised Land, in the land of Canaan, we would be lucky that there's probably several hundred thousand people living. And so the cities that we are going to be running across here are not major metropolitan areas as we think about them, of millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people, but rather they are likely to be thousands into the tens of thousands range for these cities. And so Shechem would be one of those cities of probably a few thousand to a few tens of thousand people living. Now, the Oak of Moreh that is mentioned here is a significant tree. They would have left certain trees on the landscape to grow to their full potential. And these trees became significant landmarks and places where you could go and sit under and transact business and meet people, things of that nature. So he goes to Shechem, and he goes somewhere near where this Oak of Moreh were. And that is where God appears to him again. Verse number 7. Then he who is appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring, or your seed. And the seed promise in the book of Galatians chapter 3 that I mentioned a while ago, that Paul makes a big deal out of, that's what's being represented here. Now, I appreciate that the English Standard Version kept this Hebrew word as a singular English word instead of going with descendants, plural. It can mean descendants, but its singular nature is very important to the later argument that Paul makes. So I like this collective singular that is used here. So to your offspring or your seed, I will give this land. So God makes the promise, your descendants, plural, are going to be living here. And we know that that comes to pass. The people who are reading the book of Genesis for the very first time would be the Israelites coming out of Egypt, heading for the promised land where they're going to live. So that's going to be the fulfillment of this passage. But I want you to keep in the back of your mind Paul's argumentation that the ultimate seed of Abraham is Jesus. And therefore, ultimately, the land belongs to him. And when he comes back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords and brings into existence the new heaven and new earth, I believe he will divvy up the land to those who are inheriting that new earth so that each person will live in a specific place and engage in agriculture. That kind of gets back into the idea of the millennial period that we talked about at the end of season number 4. So what does Abram do when God makes this promise to him? It says that he built there an altar to he who is, who had appeared to him. So he set up an altar. The purpose of an altar is to offer a sacrifice. Now, some sacrifices are offered for sin. That doesn't appear to be the case here. This is more than likely a thanksgiving offering. It is his way of saying, God, I've heard what you've told me, and I appreciate it. Thank you for choosing me to be your follower, to be your man. So he builds an altar, and this marks that site there by the Oak of Moreh, the big tree of Moreh at Shechem, as a worship site for the one true God. Probably the people of that region would have avoided using that site for anything common thereafter. Because even if they were simply superstitious about things spiritual, they would have known that a very important person contacted the spirit world at that site and made a worship site. Now, the reason I'm making a big deal out of it in this point is because later in the book of Genesis, one of Abram's descendants will be at this exact same site with the exact same tree, and he also will offer a sacrifice and an altar here. And so I want us to be ready for that later story so that I can reference back to here when we get to that later point. Verse number 8. From there, he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent. Now, it didn't have that name at that time. That is a later name. But Moses is doing what a lot of historians do. When you're writing, you give people the names of places that they're familiar with so that they can connect to it in their own minds, in their own understanding of geography. So he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel, which would be south from Shechem on this trade road that follows the high point of the land from north to south or south to north. And he pitched his tent there with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. Now, the Israelis are going to carry out a military operation in that exact site later. But that is another story. There he built an altar to He Who Is and called upon the name of He Who Is. So he now sets up another worship site, offers another sacrifice, and he evidently stays here for a little bit of time and carries on business and therefore wanted a place where he could show proper loyalty to the God who called him out of the north country to come to this promised land. So this is another reason why Bethel becomes an important site to the Israeli people. It doesn't start just simply with Jacob stopping there on his way north and setting up a stone because there he saw the ladder or the stair step with the angels going back and forth and called it Beth-El, the house of God. This is the gate of God. It was Abram who was first there and used it as a worship site. But Abram has still not been told by God to stop. He's not been told to settle down in any particular one place just yet. His journey continues. So verse number 9. Abram journeyed on, still going toward the Negev. Now, Negev is the name for the south desert of Canaan. Somewhere right around Hebron, which is south of Jerusalem, about 30-some miles, the greenery starts to become less prominent. And pretty soon, as you leave the hill country and go down in elevation, you end up in the dry area of the northern Sinai wilderness. And so that's the Negev. It's the south part of Canaan, the north part of the Sinai. And what does he run into when he gets to that area? Verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land. There was not enough water to go around for whatever reason. Something had disrupted the rain cycle in Canaan. And it might be that God's judgment was being carried out against the Canaanites because they were under his judgment from time to time because of their sin. But whatever the reason, Abram makes a choice on his own here that he is not going to stay in the promised land that God told him to go to, but instead spend the famine time in a place that isn't touched so easily by lack of rain, and that would be Egypt. So this is the first of several personal choices that Abram makes that causes ripples of consequence later in the story. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Now, the reason he would go to Egypt is because Egypt doesn't grow its grain based on rain, not at least rain there. The Nile River comes into existence deep down in the heartland of Africa, in the Congo area, where monsoons come on a regular schedule and just drench those jungles, those areas, with lots and lots of rain. And that rain flows northward along the Nile and brings a flood on a regular basis to the Nile, particularly the Delta region, which deposits a whole bunch of good, fresh, fertile sediment soil. And then the people living in those regions in Lower Egypt, they go out and plant as the floodwaters are receding in that fresh soil. And then they use irrigation techniques, pumps of some sort, some sort of water wheels, that they can bring the water out of the Nile into irrigation ditches and keep all those freshly planted crops well watered. And so Egypt is a major breadbasket, regardless of what the weather cycle in the Eastern Med might be. So that's why he went there. That's why others in the story that comes up later will go there. But this is what happens while he's there. Verse 11. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance." Now, she's somewhere in her 60s, her later 60s, when this is said to her. She will live to be 137. So you should think of her in our terms more of being in her late 30s, early 40s, okay? So she is very beautiful. And he says, when the Egyptians see you, they're going to say, this is his wife. And then they're going to kill me. But they will let you live. So he's afraid that when he gets there, as a foreigner, he's going to be looked at as a target. And somebody with power and prominence is going to say, I want that beautiful woman as my own. So I'm going to kill this guy that's married to her, take her and all his stuff. So Abram has a plan to try to keep that from happening. And here's his plan. So say you are my sister, which is true, but he's practicing a half-truth here because she's his half-sister. So say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. Now, why is that a better situation? Because as the older brother of a sister, he would control who could plead to marry her. They would have to treat him nicely in order to get access to woo her. And so this would delay the process, he figures, of them wanting to move forward with violence to get her as their wife. Because the dating process, the betrothal process, could drag on for several years, especially if there's lots of wealth attached to the situation, lots of prominence. So this is his way of delaying any attempts on his life or attempts to take her as wife, because he doesn't plan to be here permanently. He's only here temporarily. But the best laid plans of mice and men surely come to nothing, right? He did not think through all the possibilities. So verse 14, when Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. So he'd expected that. And when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. See, he expected that he would have to be dealing with peers. People like himself who had a lot of property, as in animals, and a lot of retainers, as in servants. So if he was dealing as a peer, as an equal with all these other guys, he could kind of control that situation. He didn't think about the possibility that somebody superior to him might come into the story. And that's exactly what happens. The Pharaoh of the land, the king of Egypt, takes note of Sarai, believes that she is single, because that's the impression that Abram's been giving right now, very foolishly. And so he just simply says, I want her to come and live in my palace as I woo her, as I start making the overtures of having her become my wife and my queen. And Abram couldn't stop that. Verse 16, and for her sake he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. So the Pharaoh of Egypt, thinking that Abram could be his brother-in-law, tries to bring him on board with this fait accompli, this accomplished fact, this accomplished act that he's getting married to Sarai. And Abram is now caught in his half-lie. And it's a mess. And of course, because we've run out of time, we're going to have to put a little cliffhanger in here and come back tomorrow and finish up this story on how God had to get Abram out of this mess that he got himself into.